Hello, check. I didn't really know what story to tell tonight, but I recently got a Facebook message from a high school friend of mine, who I'm gonna call Kurt. and it was of this this AIM conversation we'd had in high school, and he said, "Hey, man, you should read this conversation and see what jerks we were when we were 18." and I didn't want to read it because I didn't want to remember what a jerk I was when I was 18. But this is a story about him trying to get away. And so I was 18, I was in high school, I was having a house party at my house, like I would do. My dad would go away on these business trips and I would throw house parties. And I don't have a clear memory of this, but I drank a lot at my party, I passed out. And then at 2 a.m, the house phone starts ringing, and there was one in my room, and I pick it up, and this voice goes, "Mr. Pijuan," and that's my last name and my dad's last name. "I believe your son and my son are engaging in sex, drugs, and alcohol." And I just go, "What?" "I'm not my dad, man. I don't know what you're talking about." And really, my only regret, I'll tell you right now that my only regret about this story is that I didn't respond to him by saying, you know, "with each other." But I have no idea what's going on. This guy is mad. I don't even know who he is. So I go, I open the door to my room, and my friend Kurt is standing there in the hallway, and he had not been at the party earlier. He's standing there in the hallway, he's in his underwear. And I'm like, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "You agreed to help me run away." And that was my dad on the phone, because he knows I'm here. And so we go downstairs. He's like, "Come downstairs." And we go downstairs, and my living room is just full of all these garbage bags full of stuff. There's like 2 garbage bags full of CDs, and like 2 garbage bags full of books, and a garbage bag with like a computer in it, and garbage bags full of clothes. And I'm just imagining him, you know, throwing these garbage bags out of his window, trying to escape from his oppressive parents. But he did not get away, despite the fact that we had apparently devised this elaborate plan to smuggle him across the state border or something. I told this story to Tom earlier. The side note is that he was standing in his underwear outside of my door at 2 a.m. because he had just lost his virginity at my house. But that has nothing to do with getting away. Oh, maybe. But we did not get away. It was just really embarrassing. We had to drive all of his stuff back to his parents' house, and they were really mad. Wrote a really angry email to my dad, who was then really mad at me. They're really passive-aggressive people. But that's my story of attempting to escape and not escaping.
Thanks, Adrian. Our list is now empty. That was the one name on our list. So if you would like to tell a story, you can either jump up here right now, or when I coerce the next person into telling their story, you can come and sign up. Oh, Bill's telling a story. Bill's gonna save me.
I don't know if I'm gonna save anybody with this story. Why did the stories come from where I was 13 years old? When I heard this theme, Danny, behind the bar, thought of this theme. Thank you, Danny. The big word that came to me was regret. And I was trying to think of something less obvious, but the one that just kept coming back to me was when I was 13, I was this shy, pretty geeky, classic rock listening, Dungeons and Dragons playing, dork. And with that combination of things, I was, being 13, perpetually frustrated by my sexual frustration, hormonal explosion, inability to satisfy any of those things with another person anyway. And So I had about a year and a half of this kind of turmoil going on inside of me. And I got an invitation to go to a friend's home in the mountains of North Carolina that summer when I was 13. And without realizing it, my friend who I was going to visit, his name is Neil, and his family, they invited some British sisters to come over to North Carolina as well, who I knew from England. And unbeknownst to me at the time, the older of the sisters, who was also 13, had a tremendous crush on me. And it was the first kind of overwhelmingly emotional kind of attraction that somebody had ever shown me or thrown my way. And I was completely inept at dealing with it and really didn't know what to do. So the week or so that Sally was her name, Sally was there, she was kind of following me around like a puppy dog all week, and I really didn't, like I said, didn't really know what to do. And one night, Neil and I were in our bedroom, and Sally and her sister were in her bedroom, and Neil and I were preparing to go to sleep, and Sally comes knocking on our door and wants to come inside. And we invite her in, and Neil, being the more outgoing one of us, proceeded to, keeping this G-rated, but proceeded to make some things happen that I wasn't really prepared for. And one thing led to another, and Sally wound up in my bed with me. And I didn't really know what to do. And things kind of, one thing led to another, but she ended up trying to kiss me, and at that point I'd never even kissed a girl, so again, just kind of letting it happen, our heads came together and our teeth clanked together, and it almost knocked the teeth out of my skull. And in my moment of panic when that happened, I was so embarrassed, I just kind of rolled over and cowered and hoped she would just go away and the whole situation would end. And it did thankfully end up happening that way at the moment, but in retrospect, hearing about how she talked about that evening and behaved the week after I had left, it led me to believe that something clearly had gone without happening. It was something that certainly got away. So in the essence of that, I mean, I've always learned to seize opportunity rather than let it fly away, just like I did that night. So thank you.
Thanks, Bill. If you're just joining us, I think I've seen a couple people trickle in. This is The Conk. It's live storytelling by audience members. Stories 5 minutes or less with no notes on a theme. And this month's theme is the one that got away. So if you've got a story, who's got a story? All right. I've got one more fallback story. As soon as he's finished ringing someone up at the cash register. Jordan, are you ready? All right.
Hello, everybody. Taking this off. All right. Woo. Bill, some things in your tale there really rang true with me. I was a pretty big dork when I was 13 as well. And I think that's when you're in middle school, like sixth grade, seventh grade, you're about 13, right? That's kind of where you are. Anyway, it's that time period, and there's a girl, and we'll get to her in a second, because first you have to get a picture of who I was when I was that age. And I was much shorter to begin with, and I had white blonde hair. Like, I did not have a big shiny red beard yet. That didn't come until eighth grade, which was awesome. That was really, that was a big leap forward there. Having a goatee was very cool. At sixth grade, having a rat tail with a bowl cut was not so cool. And that's what I had. and I just, you know, it's because I had it in fifth grade and I had it in fourth grade. And my mom would literally just put the bowl on my head and cut around, and it was fine. It was quick, and I didn't like people fussing about my head. And the rat tail, I don't know. The rat tail was cool. It curled. It was a little curly rat tail. And it just kind of, I forgot about it probably. And so it just stayed there, you know? I mean, you don't see it. It's back there somewhere. So it was just something that was my look. And my mom still kind of dressed me. I had a lot of polo shirts, you know, the one with the little alligator in the side. You guys know those. And, you know, I don't know, jeans or shorts. I don't wear shorts ever anymore. I'll wear a kilt, but I won't wear shorts unless I'm swimming. But then I would wear shorts and my knees would show. And that's something, I don't know. I don't like showing my knees off to people. But anyway, so here I am, and I've discovered Dungeons and Dragons, which is also really fun. I haven't discovered music. And a few years of sort of in this same time period, Kurt Cobain died, and people were like, kids in my school were kind of freaking out about that, and I was like, who? You know, like I had no idea. My first album was a Journey tape. And my second album was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles soundtrack with MC Hammer, which was really pretty good. we need to get it on the iPod, by the way. But anyway, so I was really just like, I was in my own little world walking around here. Well, sometime in this sixth grade period, going to school and everything, this young Latino girl named Annalita had a crush on me, and she asked me out, and I was just like, sure, great, a girl likes me, wonderful. And girls would like me periodically. Like, I had my first kiss when I was in preschool, and I had a girlfriend in like fourth grade too, but you know, we didn't even, I mean, we held hands and like played games together, marbles or something like that. So it wasn't really like, you know, it wasn't, this girl Annalita was like my first real girlfriend. Like, we went to the movies, and we would sit in the way back, and we would make out the whole time. And it was really, you know, like, every movie, I don't even know what we saw ever. You know, you guys have all, I mean, hopefully you've been there, because it's a great place to be. First love interest, making out in the back of a movie theater. What else? We went to my elementary school, and we would make out there. We'd just go places and make out. And, you know, different scenery was in the background, and it didn't matter a whole lot. But it was, you know, it was the first tongue kiss, which was also pretty sweet. And so she was such a sweet, sweet girl. But she would tell me these stories about her life. I had no idea what it was like to be, you know, a young Latino girl. I believe she was from Puerto Rico. And she had, there was a number of other Puerto Rican, or anyway, I didn't know at the time. I was, you know, I was a kid, so I just knew they spoke Spanish, and they were all, you know, they were all friends. They all knew each other. They could speak Spanish together, and so I was kind of led into the crowd a little bit. Some of the Latino boys were pretty intimidating to everybody else, but I was cool in with Annalita, and so this was fine. I got some more cool points there with some of my other friends as well, but she would tell me these stories, and I would just go along with them. And one of the bigger ones was that she had a twin sister, and they would take turns going to school. And so sometimes, like, I'd be in the lunch line, and I'd see my girlfriend. I'd walk over there, and I'd put my arm around her. She'd be like, who are you? And I'm like, you, what, huh? And she'd be like, oh, my sister told me about you. And you, okay, well, yeah, all right, yeah, right. And then she would, like, pretend to be my girlfriend, but, you know, at that point, I was completely flabbergasted. I was like, what? Wait, what? And she insisted that she had a mole that was different, but I could never tell that. I never even saw the mole. She would point to it, and I didn't see it there, but she insisted it was there. And then when she wasn't her sister, it wasn't there, and, man, it was confusing. And I don't really even know if she was telling the truth or not. She might have been telling the truth. I have no idea. I have no idea. We just had a lot of fun together at the movies. And then one day, this would have been after the summer. No, it was after spring break. And I came back after spring break. I had this great teacher. He was real fun. He was like a jokester. He would throw rubber chickens if people weren't paying attention. And he was a real nice guy. And we shared a class together, me and Annalita. And she wasn't there the first day of spring break. And he came over to me. He's like, "Oh, I'm really sorry to hear about you guys." And I was like, What do you mean?" And he's like, "Well, wait a minute, she didn't tell you?" And he's like, "I don't think I should tell you." And I was, "What is going on? She wasn't there all day. She wasn't there all day the next day." And finally, I was like, you have to tell me. Like, I've called her house. She's not answering, you know. I have no idea what's going on." And he's like, "Well, she moved back to Puerto Rico. She didn't tell you?" And so, you know, it was just like, oh, that happened. Okay. And I guess I was sad, but I didn't cry. But I also just kept expecting her to come back because, like, it was probably just her twin sister that went to Puerto Rico.
Thanks, Jordan. While I'm up here, I'd also like to thank everyone who's told a story so far, and also Satchel's Lightning Salvage for hosting us, and Grow Radio for having this event. So thanks to all of those. So has anyone thought of... Oh, all right. Rick?
Yes.
All right.
I wasn't planning on telling one tonight, and this just sort of popped into my head. It's actually about both a ex-girlfriend and fishing, but it's not really about either one, so I figured it sort of meets the stereotypical side of what you expect for these. When I was about 22, I had a girlfriend at the time, and we decided to take an extended trip to Baja California. And so we got in her sort of beat up Honda Accord and just hit the road, and our plan was to spend about 4 weeks sort of living off the water as it was, and just kind of camping on beaches and driving around Baja. Back in a time when you could do that without, you know, fear of being killed and cut up in little pieces, and it was actually quite safe until recently. So we hit the road, got into Baja, and actually on the way to Baja, we stopped at a tackle store, and I went in and I'd fished a lot in the South. I'd never fished on the West Coast. I'd lived in California for years, but never went fishing. So I didn't really know what I was doing in Pacific marine environments, but I bought a bunch of lures of different sorts, just ones that looked interesting and whatnot. And so the first day that we actually got out of the cities and down into the really remote areas, we stopped along the coast, and there was a couple little houses there. And I decided to try my hand at fishing. It was really rocky. The waves were really dynamic, and it was really windy. So I tied up some of the lures, put them on, and set out to catch some food for dinner that night. And after I was out there for about 15 minutes without any luck, this guy, this old guy, I remember his white hair kind of standing up and just looking a little crazy, but didn't appear to be a Mexican guy, came walking up, and he started yelling at me. And I couldn't hear him because it was so windy and the waves. And he was saying something like, "Salt in the hills, you need all those." And so I just ignored him first, and he got closer, and he's, "You'll spit in the hills, you need all those." And when he finally got close enough, I realized he was British, and he was telling me, "Stop spinning your wheels, you'll lose all your lures." And he's telling me that it was just too rocky to use lures, and I was going at it all wrong. So then I was just a little bit miffed that somebody was telling me what to do, and it, you know, it wasn't like a Mexican guy came along and told me this. So I proceeded to continue, and sure enough, I lost all my lures. And that was it for fishing, because I had no other equipment, and we were in really remote areas. We were just, you know, sleeping on the beach the whole time, and so I was like, well, that's it. But the nice thing about it was it kind of became a running joke between myself and Sharon. So whenever, you know, we'd just be driving down the road or on the beach, and she would say, "You're spinning your wheels," and I would say, "You'll lose all your lures," and it was the running theme for the whole time. And so the trip continued, and we learned very quickly that you have to be careful driving, especially in Baja, because there's some road hazards that aren't common in the U.S., and they're basically amounts to what literally translates as dip or vado. They put these signs up, but rather than just a dip, it's sort of a perpendicular box that the bridge just drops straight down vertically a couple feet, goes for about 20 feet, and then goes back up again. And they do these because it's cheaper than actually building a culvert under the road. So when you have flash floods and you have, you know, the rare occasions when it rains in the desert, the water just goes through these things rather than build up elsewhere. And you have to slow down to at least 20 miles an hour. And Sharon, as wonderful as she was guilty of two things. And that was looking towards the direction she was driving. So whenever we would be near a cliff and there was a really pretty view, she would start to drive off the cliff. And she liked to speed, and there were no speed limits, so she would just go, you know, as fast as she wanted to, and she wouldn't pay attention to the vados. So after hitting them a few times, I finally sat down and just had a really serious talk. And said, "Look, this is bad. You gotta be alert. I don't care how fast you drive, but you gotta slow down for the vados, or we're gonna end up, you know, getting stuck in the desert, and who knows what's gonna happen." So she was pretty good after that. And another week went by, and we decided to take a rather long shortcut. Like most shortcuts, it ended up being the long cut, across to get from one highway to another, and it involves a dirt road that was, it looked like it was only about 15 miles long or 20 miles long, but it was nothing but a series of rocks that somebody had at some point driven on top of, and you know, maybe it would have been fine in a four-wheel drive truck, but we're in a Honda Accord, so it's about 5 miles an hour. So I drove for 6 hours straight and just sort of going over these boulders. Some of them were, you know, couple feet large, and finally got out and got onto the paved road. And at that point, I just couldn't drive anymore because I was so tired. And so Sharon said, "Oh, I'll drive. Don't worry about it." So she gets in the car, and I proceeded to fall asleep. And the next thing I remember is this tremendous pain on the top of my head, and then hitting against the dashboard. And what had happened is she had hit a vado going about 80 miles an hour, and so my head just went into the ceiling and then hit the dashboard. And I'm just in a daze, so I just woke up, but I remember looking over at the dashboard, and I just see this bright red light on. So she stops the car, and I get out, and I look back, and there's nothing but a trail of oil that's going behind us. And I look under the car, and it's as if someone just took a fist and punched through the oil pan. And we're in the middle of the desert, there's no cars around. And I looked at her, and I was so angry at the time that I just knew that if I said anything, it was just, you know, it was going to make a bad situation worse. So I just started walking off into the desert. And what was amazing this time is that we hadn't really had much rain, but at this time, sympathetic nature comes and it starts to drizzle a little bit as I'm just, you know, and I didn't know where I was going. I was going to walk in the desert until I was all right with the situation. And right at the point that I was almost out of earshot, she says, "You're spinning your wheels, you'll lose all your love." And it was enough to break me out of this terrible anger that I had. So I turned around, went back, and we kind of laughed about it. And then we're like, "Well, I guess we're, you know, camping here on the side of the road." And fortunately, after a couple hours, a guy came by on a horse and saw what was going on. He said, "Oh, don't worry, I'll be back." And you're like, "Okay, whatever." So I'm thinking he's like going to go back and you know, come back in his pickup truck. He does come back later on his horse with a large rope, and he actually tied the car to a horse and towed us to this little village and takes us. And I think, what are we going to do now? Now we're in a village, but it's not like there's, you know, anywhere to fix this. Well, ended up there was an American expat that was living there who had a car repair business. So we pulled into there, and he's like, "Oh, sure, I could fix this. You're going to have to go get the part." So we ended up hiking to San Diego and got the part. Came back, the guy, in addition to being a mechanic, was an alcoholic and had got into the trunk and drank everything we had that was, you know, like that we were carrying with us and ate all the food that we had. But we did bring him the part. He put a new oil pan in and we got on the road and made it back to the States. All right, thanks.
Thanks so much, Rick. So did that spark anyone else's memory about one that got away?
All right, I have a story about fish, but it's really short. And Bill and I were in St. Joe's Peninsula, and it was really early in the morning, really early. It was before all our friends came up, and we decided to go walk on the beach. And the thing about St. Joe's Peninsula is nobody is on the beach in the morning. Actually, nobody's on the beach ever. And that's pretty much why you go there. And if you get up in the morning, you can look down one side, and it's absolutely, there's no footprints as far as you can see. And we got up and we were walking, and it was maybe, I don't know if it was 8 or 9, it may have been as early as 7. I'm an insomniac, so I'd probably been up all night. And we headed off in one direction, and we got to this point where the tide had gone out. It hadn't been out long. And there, like caught, was this little perfect dead, but still perfect. I'm not gonna lie and say I was sad because I was so fascinated. It was this perfect dead black tip shark pup. And I remember like standing there and just being like awestruck. And I took like a million pictures. And I tell the story now, nobody believes me, like that we found it. You know, it's the kind of story you have to tell, like, you know, have the person that was with you, like, there. I mean, like, remember we found that black-tipped shark pup, because, you know, juvenile sharks are so rare that, you know, nobody ever finds them. But there he was, like, just perfect. And we didn't touch him or anything. We just there, you know, sat there and stood. You know, I took a million pictures, and I remember that hard drive crashed, and I had a bunch of them up on my MySpace. That was how long ago it was I had a MySpace. So embarrassing to admit you had a MySpace. You all had one though, you know you did. But anyway, we continued on, you know, and left him there. And walked all the way down, and as we came back, I remember, like, there were all these rangers and all these people, all these scientists, they looked very scientific, I remember that. Like, crowded around him, you know, and picking him up and carrying him off. And I remember for ages I had that picture, and it's somewhere, you know, in my files. In that, you know, hard drive I keep in the anti-static bag, convinced that somehow I'm going to find somebody who can salvage those pictures at some point. But they're probably lost, and they're probably just like him, you know, because they've all kind of gotten away. But it's my story.
Thanks, Melissa. All right, so my list is still empty, and I'm just gonna stand here and hope someone comes up with a story right quick. Yeah? All right, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hey guys, my name is Brian, and my story was November of 2011. I was driving out to Jacksonville one night. And I ride a motorcycle a lot. So I was driving out there, middle of the night, to make a purchase from Craigslist, and that was pretty much the only time I could meet this guy at a gas station out there. So I'm driving back in the middle of the night, down Route 301, Waldo Road, and a deer appears right in front of me. The last thought, you know, the only thought in my head is, well, that's it. You're on a motorcycle, that's it, it's over. And then the impact happens. And my shoe flies off, that's the one thing I notice. It just goes poof. Oh man, I was still in dress clothes, coming out of work and everything that night. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm still alive. Okay, so I slow my bike down and I pull over. And my foot is just throbbing. I'm like, damn, you know, where's my shoe at? So I go back and kind of wander on the side of the road for my shoe in the middle of the night, walking around with this really hurt foot. But I'm like, man, where is my shoe at? And I find my shoe. And then my second thought comes, I'm like, well, my deer's out there somewhere. I must have hurt her, right? Maybe she's dead, who knows? I've got a truck I can go to and get some venison, don't just let it waste. So I spent about 10 minutes searching for this deer on the side of Waldo Road. I'm like, yeah, it's gonna be merciful, you know? Get some venison out of it. And I never did find her. And she became the one that got away.
Thanks for your story. So this one time I studied in Spain one semester, and one of the last trips we went on was to Barcelona, and it was really the first time that I had been in Europe, and so when I had been taking kind of little weekend trips, They had all been to cities, and I was so sick of being in cities, and this was one of the last cities that we were going to be in, and I was just dreading it. I was like, I don't want to be in a city anymore. I want to see the sky, and I want to see parks and green fields that I can roll around in. And I was dreading it. I just didn't want to go. Got to Barcelona. Loved it. So that was nice. I like to buy earrings in every city that I, or every place that I go to, because I feel like it's a lot better than a knickknack or something that I have to dust every once in a while. So, you know, every time I put the earrings on, I think of that place that I went to. And so I found this great pair of earrings. I'm not wearing them tonight, I should have, but they're kind of a, I think they were made out of some kind of iron, but they were really delicate and they were kind of curly and they just had a gem right at the end of them. So I bought these earrings and that was my Barcelona souvenir. And I was at the, there's this long row of shops outside, and it was kind of touristy, but there were really cool things that the people were selling. And so I was with a group of friends, and we had made it all the way down to the end of the shop, of this line of shops, and we came to the last tent. I really think it was the very last tent, and it was all of these handcrafted leather goods, things made out of leather. And I'm sure there's a word for that that I can't remember right now. There was this belt, and it was hand carved. It had all this delicate carving in it, and it was hand painted, and I think there were flowers, but it was kind of abstract looking, and I loved it. But it was kind of expensive, and I had more places to go, and so I already had my Barcelona earrings, so I didn't want to buy this belt. And I still think of that damn belt to this day. Every time I put on another belt, I say, I could have that belt from Barcelona, but you know what? I got this dumb belt from Flashbacks instead. So for me, that belt is the one that got away. Thanks. So, how about you? What got away from you? Anyone? Was that a gesture? No. Oh, okay. I'm just hoping for signs here. Yeah. All right. Welcome to the stage, Mr. Condra.
Hi. For some reason during my life, I seem to be a demon-possessed babe magnet. I have had some girlfriends that make Subble look sane. But anyway, so this happened, the first one, that's the only one I'm going to tell about tonight, is I was 19, and I was raised, just a little bit of background, raised in Chattanooga, Tennessee, very, very strict Baptist church background. By the time I got into high school, I kind of deconverted. I kind of became an agnostic, you know. And so I was going to college, the State University there in Chattanooga, and I started working at a clothing store there, and this young lady got hired in, and she looked, I always had the hots for Twiggy. I don't know why. But when I was an adolescent, I had the hots for Twiggy. I just thought Twiggy was the coolest thing in the world. And so the girl that got hired in with me, who was also 19 at the time, she was like the spitting image of Twiggy, but she was endowed a little bit better than Twiggy, okay? And so it turned out she was a Baptist preacher's daughter. But she was a bad Baptist preacher's daughter. And so we started going out and hanging out. Her father, it turned out, her father had sent her to Chattanooga because she was such, well, when I first met her, I thought, oh, I'm kind of the worldly, you know, worldly guy, and this is the Baptist preacher's daughter. Listen. In her adolescence, she had done things like stolen her father's credit cards, jumped on an airplane, flown to California, like San Francisco, lived on a hippie commune. Like, this was when she was 13, 14, 15. Slept with everybody on the commune, did a ton of LSD, you know, smoking tons of all kinds of stuff. And then she also got arrested in the big May Day anti-Vietnam War protest when she was about 17 or 18, 72 or something like that. And her, of course, when I first met her, she looked like this nice little Baptist preacher's daughter, you know, who was really cute, you know. And so we started going out, and she told me more about her life. She had lived a pretty chaotic life. And so one night, we're watching this Frankenstein movie on TV. It was like we had what's called Saturday Night Shock Theater in Chattanooga. And we were standing up watching this, and I told, and I always felt like she was keeping something from me. And so I started doing this, "Ruth, I know what's going on with you." And she said, "No, you don't." I said, "Yeah, I know." Well, of course, I didn't know. I did not know. I had no clue. But I was trying to get her to kind of open up, and I knew there was a part of her, a dimension of her that I was not being a part of, in terms of her, you know, emotions and all that kind of stuff. So she started going into a trance kind of state, and her voice changed, and she started staring out, eyes got glassy and glazed over, and she started telling me that when she was 13 or 14, she did some, which Baptist preacher's daughters should do this, she did, I guess candle gazing is an occultic practice or something, where you gaze at a candle and you supposedly it helps connect you to the spirit world, or you know, something like that. And so she had done this, and she had a guardian angel who started talking to her, telling her what to do. So her father sent her to Chattanooga to this real strict Baptist college called Tennessee Temple College. This was kind of Chattanooga's version of Bob Jones University, folks. Okay. Lots of rules, lots of control over the students. And so so I said, you know, "Ruth, so what she told me was basically this guardian angel tells her to do all this crazy stuff she does. You know, steal her dad's credit cards and go bet everybody, all the men at the commune, and run away, and all this rebellion, but since going to this college, she had to take a course in the Bible, and of course, like in most fundamentalist religious churches, they may talk a lot about God, but they also talk a lot about the devil. And so she started finally thinking that maybe this was not an angel, a guardian angel, speaking to her. Maybe this was a demon. I said, "Wow," I kind of got freaked out. And so I said, "Well, what's the demon's name?" Now, how I came up with knowing to ask her that question, I don't know. But she said, "Well, I can't tell you." In this very spaced out, very different voice, "I can't tell you." I said, "Come on, Ruth, you can tell me. I'm your friend, Larry, you know, I care about you." She said, "No, I can't tell you. It won't let me tell you." I said, "Come on, Ruth, tell me. I'm, you know, I'm here for you. I'm supportive of you." And she turned to me and she said, "It's time for you to go." And so I kind of got nervous. She had had some, you know, I knew she had had some very chaotic depression, and I think there was a suicide attempt back there somewhere and everything. So, you know, so she had her troubles. And so I freaked out, and so I went home, talked to my sister. At that time, I understand I was kind of agnostic as far as faith was concerned. I didn't really believe in anything much. I won't say I was an atheist, but I was definitely, I questioned everything. And so my sister put me in contact with this Bible teacher, a lady who teaches the Bible in Chattanooga. Actually, she has a worldwide ministry now. She's right up there with Billy Graham, kind of. But she recommended I take Ruth to Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob was a Christian psychologist in Chattanooga. Because Dr. Bob, he was trained, he's a professional. I said, okay. So I went and talked to Ruth about it. And, so first I go to see Dr. Bob myself and tell him this is what happened. And he gave me a booklet, and the title of the booklet was Victory Over the Devil. And it had all this, this is 1973, so it had this psychedelic, pictures, victory over the devil, and this devil outline in the back and everything. And so I took that with me, and he said, give this to Ruth and let her read it. And so Ruth was working at the clothing store which we both worked at, and so I told her at lunchtime, come on out and talk to me. I think I found somebody that can help you with your problems. And so I had this book sitting, in between our seats, and so she came in and sat down. And as soon as she came and sat down in my car, she saw that psychedelic little booklet, and she picked it up, and she said, in this voice, this creepy kind of weird voice, people shouldn't read books about this. I said, oh my God. So I told her about the appointment. It was the next morning. I picked her up. We went down to Dr. Bob's office. Dr. Bob actually was in a very 10-story professional building. There were lawyers and doctors. And Dr. Bob actually had a PhD from Michigan State University. And of all things, pastoral psychotherapy. Believe it or not, a state university gave a degree in that at one time. And so Dr. Bob was a very 6 feet tall, very dapper dresser, very eloquent, very edgy, just had that whole professorial thing going, he's the professor. And so Ruth on the way down there was fine, but once we hit Dr. Bob's office, she went into this lethargic, shuffling, spaced out persona again. And so she went in with Dr. Bob for about 20 minutes and they talked. And then Dr. Bob came out. Now, I'm just somebody who was dating her, basically. I'm not her husband, But Dr. Bob had me come in, and Ruth's sitting there, all spaced out, looking like she's totally, blitzed on something. And Dr. Bob proceeded to tell me that he had asked Ruth to, confess Jesus Christ as Lord, and she couldn't do it. And to read a Bible verse, and she refused it. Now, she was a Baptist preacher's daughter, so she'd been raised in this very conservative kind of faith her whole life, so she knew it. And so then Dr. Bob started an exorcism on Ruth right there in front of me. I didn't know he was going to do that. I thought he was just going to talk to her, about her problems. And so he picked up his Bible and he started saying, he also had asked Ruth also, what was the name of this spirit or guardian angel or demon or whatever? And she also told him she couldn't say what it was, but she thought she could write it down. And what she wrote down was the name Mora, M-O-R-A. There is a little town in Louisiana named Mora, Louisiana, I found out years later. Anyway. So Dr. Bob started commanding Mora to leave her. Okay, in the name of Jesus, I command you to leave, Mora. Well, she starts screaming. Now listen, folks, I had been raised in a home with a mother and a sister, and the women in my home were all very calm. I never had been around a hysterical woman in my whole life. Now there are also hysterical men in the world, so I'm not trying to make things equal. But Ruth started screaming she turned to me, Larry, get me out of here! Get me out of here! And I said, no, we're gonna stay and finish all this, because Dr. Bob is a professional. He's got his doctorate up there on the wall. He's got very nice furniture in a bookcase. And all the accoutrements of professionalism, And I'm a struggling freshman at UTC flunking all my courses because I'm bored to death with school by that time. And so he kept on doing this for about 15 minutes. And she's screaming and she's covering her ears. And crying, just crocodile tears, just screaming. At one point she tried to get up and walk out. Dr. Bob pushed her back into the chair. Big professional no-no, now that I work in mental health. you know, you don't do that. I mean, she had the right to leave if she wanted to leave, right? Even if she was demon-possessed, you know? And so suddenly Dr. Bob just stopped. He just stopped. And he said, Ruth, I want to see you next week. I want to make another appointment with you. I want you to come back. And as soon as he stopped his exorcism, Ruth, her tears dried up. She was fine. And I was shocked at why he stopped, because it looked like something was about to happen. There was some kind of breakthrough that was going to happen with all this screaming and yelling and theatrics and tears and everything. And Ruth stood up and said, I need to go use the bathroom. And Dr. Bob said, yeah, there's one out in the hallway. So I turned to Dr. Bob and I said, when she had walked out, I said, why did you stop? It looked like, you know, the demons were about to leave. Now, what had happened was I had flipped back. Now that I saw this, and he's interpreting this thing for me that she has, you know, these demons. And so I'm kind of buying into his whole perspective now. And he said, well, I stopped because I have another patient coming in. I mean, this was going to be a drive-through fast food exorcism. And now that, you know, I do work in the mental health field, it's kind of like amazed, but, you know, he was going to introduce this and all in 15, 20 minutes, get her fixed and send her out the door. I was very concerned about her because I knew she was very unstable. She disappeared. She never came back. She wasn't in the women's room. And so I was freaking out. I said, oh, man, I hope she doesn't try to kill herself. I'm thinking, Dr. Bob has stirred up all these demon forces in her. They're mad as hell. You know, they've been discovered. More is going to maybe take her out or something. And so I looked all over the building. Dr. Bob did something. Of course, he had another patient coming in, so he couldn't help much. And finally, I said, well, I'll just have to drive back to her house and just wait, and hopefully she'll show up. And so I go back there, which was like, you know, 4 miles away. This is in Chattanooga, and like in November, it's like freezing cold. It's like freezing. It's like 30 degrees outside. So I stand there, I knock on her door, nobody answers. Of course, I knew she had no way to get back, right? She had no way to get back. I drove her to her appointment, I was gonna drive her back. I knew no buses went out that far. And so I stay there. I'm thinking, well, sometime in the afternoon, she's gonna show back up, hopefully. You know, if she didn't kill herself or something. And I went up and knocked on her door, nobody answers, which is what I expected. And then while I'm sitting in my car, I look up at her window and I see the curtain move a little bit. I said, she's there. So I walked up to her door, banged on her door, and I said, Ruth, I know you're in there. We got to talk. So she opens the door a little bit. There's a chain, okay? And I could see from what little I could see, she didn't have any clothes on. Now she's all giddy and laughing. And I said, we need to talk about what just happened. She said, I don't want to talk about it. Oh, it's scary. But it was like, you know, frivolous, you know? It was kind of attitude. And so I said, well, okay. So I said, I'll just go outside and wait for her till she comes out, you know? About half an hour later, she comes out dressed very nicely, like a Baptist preacher's daughter should. But behind her is this guy who's about 6 feet tall. And I walk up to her and I said, you know, Ruth, you need to, you know, now I'm buying into Dr. Bob's whole theology. I'm saying, you need to really turn your life over to God and get rid of these demons and everything. And of course, he told me to leave her alone. Okay, so what happened was, this is her ex-boyfriend that she had told me about, who she thought was pretty dumb, but she had called him and rewarded him for coming to pick her up by sleeping with him. And of course, in my mind, I'm so buying into this whole Dr. Bob's demon theory that I'm thinking, wow, those demons made her go and have sex with somebody else. It wasn't until some time later I realized that was one of those, what do you call it, an anger, a revenge elf, whatever. Anyway, she got away. I did talk to her one time after that. I don't think she had demons. I think she did have some mental health issues. Unfortunately, I got kind of trapped in Dr. Bob's world of this kind of hyper-religious, spiritual, everything's a demon kind of world for a couple of years, unfortunately, until I came out of it. But I was very fond. She was really my first kind of real, I think, girlfriend, you know. And so she made, unfortunately, a template got formed, and I picked up a couple of others kind of like her later on down the road. Anyway, that's my one that got away.
Thanks, Mr. Conjure. So, I hope during these stories, someone has thought of another something that got away from them. Yeah? All right, Sally.
This is so tall. I wasn't actually going to tell this story because it's not 100% my story. It's mostly my best friend Mel's story. So I'll preface it with two things and two sort of pieces of background information that you probably need to know for this story. And one of them is that New Jersey is about the size of a postage stamp. We got another New Jersey person? Where in New Jersey? Okay, I'm way north of you. Okay. Well, whatever. This could go on for hours. I've actually met so many people from New Jersey who were in Florida. I really got to get my license plates changed soon. But New Jersey is about the size of a postage stamp. And there's a million people, and everybody seems to be related to each other or know each other or be married to each other. I'm pretty sure I know everybody's brother-in-law in North Jersey at this point. But so another thing is that people don't leave, so the people you went to high school with are still exactly where you left them most of the time. yeah, it's terrifying, it is, and that's part of the terrifying aspect of this story, is that not only is New Jersey small, but what you do in high school doesn't ever really leave. but my best friend Mel used to, when she was in high school, go to a very specific Rocky Horror Picture Show showing at across from the Jersey Gardens Mall. And it was midnight, and she would be there in full costume. This was a full costume kind of thing. This was not a half-assed kind of Rocky Horror. She would always be as Columbia, I think. But so flash forward about 15 years from when Mel was going to Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that was also way before she knew me. So we're at this thing that happens in North Jersey every so often, and it's called the Geek Flea Market. And it's a lot of 30-something-year-old guys who have to clear out their mom's attic with... It's a lot of guys selling their Star Wars toys. So that in itself is the one that got away kind of deal, because it's a bunch of 30-year-old guys seeing what they didn't get for Christmas in 1980. but so we're walking around, and after the first circle, I saw this Han Solo wallet on one of the tables. It was this wallet, and it had Han Solo frozen in carbonite on the front of it, and I was like, Mel, I have to have this. It's my birthday. I have to buy this. It's my birthday present to myself. She's like, oh, okay, whatever. We'll make another circle. She kind of wanted to get out of there because I think she was already starting to see everyone she went to high school with. So we go back to the table where I saw this Han Solo wallet, and I was refusing to let that be the thing that got away from me. And we're talking with the guys around the table. He's sort of this geeky-looking, tall, blonde, 30-something guy. And Mel is sort of, like, looking at him and then starting to look a little nervous. And so we make our deal. I buy the wallet for, like, $2, and he gives me a silly, like, Star Wars watch, too, because it was my birthday. And we got away. She's like, we have to leave. We have to leave. I'm like, why? Like, what's up? What happened? She's like, I know that guy. I'm like, oh, we should go back and say hi to him. I don't think he recognized you. She's like, no, the last time I saw him was at Rocky Horror Picture Show, and he was wearing a tiny pair of gold shorts. We have to leave. So we got away.
Thanks, Sally. Does anyone want to jump up and tell their story before I give some thanks? I mean, we've got time for plenty of more stories, but I was just going to give Satchel's Lightning Salvage and Grow Radio one more thank you while I'm here, while people are thinking. Aw, thanks. Y'all. I know one other person has a story. Are you ready to tell your story, Danny? All right, your other bartender's gonna tell a story. Give him a hand and tip him well.
How you doing? All right, so I grew up in Miami. Yep, thank you. And in the outskirts of Miami, actually, this little place called the Redlands where, yeah, the avocado groves and citrus trees, that's where all the grapefruits and stuff get grown. Well, I got my four best friends, we all kind of lived like on the same block, and we're all the same age, and we're about 13, and every Friday or Saturday night, we would all get together and, you know, we'd say, hey, we're gonna go over to and spend the night at Mike B and Full Effect's house. Because we all had these crazy nicknames. One guy's name was Mike B in Full Effect, and that's what everybody called him. And even if he called my house, my mom would say, Mike B in Full Effect is on the phone for you. Other guy's name was Boner, and not for what you think. It's because he looked exactly like Kirk Cameron's friend on Growing Pains. Boner, if you remember, he looked exactly like him. And then there was another friend named Chickenhead Todd. And Chickenhead Todd got that name because of the way he ran. And if you've ever seen a chicken walk, it's kind of like they put their head out first, and then their body catches up, and they put their head out, and their body catches up. And that's how he ran. He ran. Somebody called him Chickenhead Todd. So this night, we were going to stay over at Boner's house. And we always did this thing where at 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd walk up to the Tom Thumb, and it was a dark road. There's no street lights out there. There's nothing. It's real dark. So we'd walk through the citrus groves to the railroad tracks, take the railroad tracks to Tom Thumb, and we'd hang out with our skateboards, and we'd wait for a cool-looking guy to walk up, and we'd say, hey, man, you buy us a 12-pack and a pack of cigarettes? And we'd take the 12-pack and the cigarettes to a railroad tracks, and we'd sit on the railroad tracks and, you know, and drink the, and we thought we were really cool. We thought that was, like, so cool. So we were walking back to Boner's house after all this, and there's one street light on Silver Palm, and we stopped kind of in the rows of the orange trees, because where the street light was, I don't know what we were doing. We were talking, and we could hear a car coming, and Mike, being Full Effect, got this really cool, this idea. He reached down, he grabbed an orange, and he threw it towards the street light, and he timed it perfect, because you couldn't see the car coming, you could just hear it. And then all of a sudden, like, you would see, like, down the road, and the street lights here, the car came, and like the orange was coming and bam, and it hit the car. And we all laughed, we're like, oh, and the car, you know, swerved and it kept going, you know, and it's a real horrible thing, you know, I'm sorry I did that now. But it was really funny back then, and no one got hurt, and we thought, you know, that's cool. Let's stand here for like 10 minutes and do that. So we did that. We stood there for about 10 minutes, and there was one car going towards the Tom Thumb, and we heard it coming, and we threw it, and boom, you know, hit the car, and the car stopped. And someone started yelling, come on out of there, hey! And we saw the car, you know, when it got in the street, like, it was this big, you know, redneck, you know, big wheel truck and stuff, and we're like, oh, man. So the guy got in his car and he drove off, and we're like, phew, dodge that bullet, all right. So let's come up with a plan. Like, if anything happens, we're going to meet on the railroad tracks under the big tree, and we'll split up, and we'll all meet back there. So about 5 minutes later, we hear a car coming. We all throw the oranges again, and then here they come. Oranges are coming. And as soon as it gets into the streetlight, we realize it's that same truck. It's that same one. And like all four oranges hit it. So the truck skids. And it locks its lights like right on us. And we're like. And then like some big fog lights come on. Boosh. And we're like, oh my God. And then everything lights up. And we're like, run. So we all start running. And I just remember I was running down this aisle. And the lights were behind me, and it's getting louder, and I know it's coming. And I'm seeing my shadows getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I'm like, oh my God, it's right behind me. And then out of this tree comes Chickenhead Todd, came running right in front of me. He's doing his Chickenhead run dance. And I want to yell to him, like, Todd! But I'm just tired, I'm like winded, I'm like, ah! And I just keep running, and the lights lock on Chickenhead Todd, and they start taking off after Chickenhead Todd. So I'm like, oh God, Todd, I pull it again. So I jump the gate, go to the railroad tracks, I go down to the tree, and I hang out there for about 2 hours, because I'm scared, really scared to walk back. And no one comes, no one else comes. So finally I get the nerve, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to walk back. So I walk back through the groves, get back to Boner's house, walk into his garage door where his bedroom was, and there were all three of them. The Boner had a black eye. Mike B in full effect had a busted lip. And Chickenhead Todd had the perfect imprint of a boot heel on his back shoulder blade. I mean, it was perfect, perfect imprint. So I was the only one that got away that night.
Thanks, Danny. You're the one that got away. All right, we're closing in. Who else has been itching to tell a story all night but hasn't had the confidence yet? He's got a bone to pick with Danny, huh? All right, well, I don't want to wrap it up quite yet. So if I go to sit down and you all turn to each other and you start telling your story about something that got away, stop and come over to me and be like, I've got a story. And then you can tell it, and it'll be great. We'd all love to hear instead of just the four people at your table. So we're going to hang out for a little bit longer. I'll wrap it up in a minute if nobody decides they've got a story to tell. So be thinking, boost your confidence. I'm excited. All right.
Wow. Although I do like that song. Maybe we could put it in the background. That'd be nice. Hi, everyone. My name is Janice. I used to have a radio show back in Blue Radio. All right, so this story takes place in 2004 when I was 16, and my parents decided to take me and my sister and her friend Pam all the way to Colorado Springs, where I have an aunt and uncle that live. This was supposed to be summertime family fun vacation. And I'm gonna pad this story first with a tiny anecdote on the way there, on this road trip. We had rented this big van, and I had taken over as my territory the big back seat where I could sleep and read until we eventually got to Colorado. I remember after a luxurious nap, waking up in this mist-strewn landscape and asking my sister, where are we? Arkansas. And as I get out into Arkansas, all I can see is the gas station we had pulled up next to. And I go in to use the bathroom, as people are wont to do. And I go into the gas station bathroom, very tiny gas station, middle of nowhere, as I said before. Did my thing and turn around to leave after washing my hands. And I see on the door, there is a big sign, the obligatory sign that says, all employees must wash their hands before returning to work. And someone had taken a Sharpie and crossed out hands and wrote Cooter, and then Spring Break 2003. And this was 2004, which means this has stayed up here for a year. So we do eventually make it to Colorado, and we decide to go to this area near Pikes Peak. I forget where, it's been a while. But this beautiful, beautiful, pristine forest. Once again, we all get out of the van, and my sister and her friend wander off, my parents wander off somewhere else, and I see this beautiful river. And I approach this pristine, gorgeous river with a waterfall in the distance, gurgling. And as I get close to this river, it's a very shallow river, about a foot deep. In the middle of this pristine, natural beauty is a 7-Eleven Big Gulp cup. Right on this rock, just like a big F you to any hiker that walked by. And so I decided, in my very innocent 16-year-old self, I'm going to get that cup, and I'm going to put it away and recycle it like a responsible person. So I take off my shoes and socks and wade into the river and get that big gulp cup triumphantly, feeling like Captain Planet from Florida. And I put it in the proper receptacle, hooray me. And feeling all jazzed up and good about myself, I start walking towards my my family who have gathered near, closer to the waterfall on this bridge. And next to the bridge is a small gathering of rocks and this gorgeous flower. And I lean down, beautiful purple white flower, and I decide, you know, I'm gonna pick a few. I'm gonna take one of these home for me as my little souvenir. Feeling, of course, still jazzed up. Look at me, I'm so awesome. Green thumb, green living it up. And after I pick the third one, I hear this loud, blood-curdling voice going, "Stop!" And it is the park ranger. And she has an entire party behind her, a little tour guide, running up to me as fast as she can, going, "Those columbines are endangered. Do you know what you're doing? That's $500 a flower." And I stop frozen with the flowers in my hand. And she comes up to me and she goes, "Didn't you see the sign in the gift shop?" Everyone else looking at me with utter disgust. I'm like, "I didn't go into the gift shop. What are you talking about? There's what gift shop?" She pulls me aside, seeing my age and my knowledge or lack of this flower and its importance, its severe importance to this ecosystem. And she tells me the story of the founder of this little park who, because I don't remember her name, but only what it sounded like, I will refer to her as Helen Keller. So back in the 19th century, Helen Keller and her friends, rich aristocrats that they were in booming Colorado Springs, would come out every weekend into the beautiful glory and pick as many columbine flowers they damn well pleased. Enough to the point where they entirely threatened the ecosystem and almost made extinct in that locale the columbine flower. And then, even though she had done all this damage to the park, they named it after her. But that was beside the point, this park guy wanted to stress. She said to me, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Florida." And she said, "Now, Janice, I'm gonna let you go. I'm not gonna call the cops," which at this point I'm, "Oh my God, what, the cops? You're gonna call the cops on me for picking flowers?" Yes. She was not going to call the cops, though, if I promised her one thing. And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "Never pick flowers again." And I was like, "Sure, sure, lady. I'll never pick flowers again." And thankfully, I was able to walk away from that situation without getting arrested, thrown into natural park jail. But then later on, I went to a restaurant with my aunt and uncle, and there were columbine flowers growing around the restaurant. And I was like, "What? I thought these were endangered." She's like, "Yeah, only in that park." So that was my one flower that got away.
Hello.
Thanks, Janice. In that little gap in through Janice's story, was anyone inspired? A light bulb? Did a light bulb go on? All right. Well, we've still got about 15 minutes until story time is over. So, if you think of one, jump up or come find me. I'll be sitting over in this area. All right, we've got one more story. I think this is gonna be our last one, so welcome Ricky.
How's it going, everyone? Cool. All right, so this is gonna be a pretty short story. I was in Haiti last weekend with a group. We were working on this documentary about the arts and culture in Haiti, and we went for this huge pre-Mardi Gras festival called Carnival. There's hundreds of thousands of Haitians everywhere. We just basically went to hang out with them and film and stuff. And on one of the days we were there, we decided to go to this place called Bassin Bleu. We have to climb a mountain in order to get there. Our truck broke down halfway, so We trekked all the way up there, and it was a long, long journey. And Bossam Blue is this place that Haitians refer to as like paradise, because there's a waterfall and it's like crystal clear blue water, and it's just perfect up there. So we're really excited. We want to get up to this place because we want to get a shot of us and the local band that live up in Bossam Blue just jamming and playing underneath the waterfall, because it's just going to be the perfect shot. So we get up to the mountain, we pay this band to go with us, and we actually had to borrow guitars from some other people when we got there, because we couldn't bring them over. We couldn't find them in time. So we're just about to get to Bossam Blue. We have to climb up these stonewall stairs and go down this rope in order to get to this specific area. And the rest of the band is in front of me. They brought our guitars and stuff. And I'm just kind of trailing behind. And I stop to take a breath. And we're right near this waterfall. And we're just kind of hanging out, waiting to start jamming underneath it, you know, to climb up there. And all of a sudden, I see something in the distance falling down. I see people freaking out. And it's actually one of our guitars. It fell in the water and everyone's just going mad and crazy. And I see the guitar just floating down the river. And we never saw the guitar again, but we did get to jam with the Haitians underneath the waterfall. So, yeah. Floated away. Gone.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ricky. I think that's going to wrap it up for the night. So thank you so much for coming out. Thanks to everyone who shared a story. Oh, wait. Is there... No? It's okay. It's all right. It's just wishful thinking on my part. But yeah, thanks so much to everyone who told a story. Thanks one more time to Satchel's Lightning Salvage and Grow Radio. Check out Grow Radio's website. GrowRadio.org. The Conk's got a Facebook page. We don't have a theme yet for next month, but check the Facebook page and we'll get one up there within the next week or so. So the March 12th. March 12th will be the next Conk, so hope to see you there. Bring your friends and bring a story. Good night.